This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to NSPS Radio Hour. We're glad to have everybody back with us for another edition today. And I want to welcome Jerry Penry to the show. Welcome, Jerry.
Hi, Kurt. Good morning.
Thanks for joining me today. I was listening in to David and the fellow he has the other show with just before us, and they were talking about drones a little bit and where those things were going. And of course, there's all kinds of things happening in that world, that's for sure. But today we're going to talk about the same world in a little different context, perhaps. Mm-hmm. A while back, I got an email from one of my friends and listeners from out in California, Phil Danskin, and I'm always asking people to help me identify potential guests. And Phil writes me an email and talks about some research he was doing and got to looking back into his roots in Nebraska. And he ran across this book being advertised called Nebraska's Early Geodetic Surveys by Gerald Penry. Mm-hmm. And so he started looking into it. And I don't know if you've ever talked to Phil or not, Jerry, but in his message to me, he says, you got to get this guy on the show. He's a surveyor. So,
yeah.
So it was great. It's great to have listeners like Phil who are always helping us look for interesting guests, because after you and I began our conversation and I started getting some stuff from you and doing my own little research, certainly you've got an interesting background. And so maybe a good way to start the show is to let people hear some about that background and what you've been doing and what you're doing now.
Okay, well, I grew up in northern Nebraska, kind of a farm boy, loved the outdoors, hunted, fished, trapped, had motorcycles, and surveying actually kind of found me. I was riding my motorcycle one day along the right-of-way of the railroad because I couldn't ride it on the roads. I was 13 years old, and something caught my eye, so I circled back, and here was this kind of a bronze disc-type thing set in a massive concrete. I'm like, what is that? And so I read it, and it said benchmark. I'd never heard of such a thing. So I went home, and this would have been about 1979. Went home, grabbed the dictionary, looked it up, and explained what it was. And so I was kind of like really intrigued by that. What was this thing doing there? 1935, and it's like, this is ancient history, and you know, who put it there? And I've always had this really inquisitive mind. And so this was about a mile from my home, so I kind of almost adopted that benchmark as being the protector of it. And another issue that came up was we were putting in a fence, and my dad got a rifle scope and mounted it onto a camera tripod, and he used that for line. And I'm like, well, that's what we're surveying. And he had me go out there, and I was running a pole or something, and he was doing left and right, and that was kind of the beginning of my surveying. In high school, I had a drafting class, so that kind of got me into drafting. And then when I turned 18, my mom hands me this brochure from a community college, and she says, pick something. And I was like, well, I don't, you know, I want to be an auto mechanic. I don't want to be a house builder. And here was a surveying and drafting program from Southeast Community College in Milford, Nebraska. And it was almost a process of elimination, and I chose that.
And so it's good that you had that prior experience a little bit.
Yeah.
And I guess I thought it was really interesting. You were talking about finding the benchmark along the railroad there, as so many of us have done over time. Mm-hmm. And I'm always communicating with the folks over at National Geodetic Survey, mm-hmm. and one of the topics that always comes up is the idea that, you know, we have all those marks out there still today, and some have GPS positions on them, some of them don't, some of them haven't been seen in decades, it seems. And so when you were talking about being the protector, I was thinking to myself, well, I guess it's kind of a shame we didn't have more protectors of the benchmarks over the years.
Exactly.
Maybe some of them wouldn't be lost these days, but that's certainly an interesting way to get involved in the profession and being able to pull the elements together. You know, you talked about the field part of it, and then of course discovering the benchmark, and then the drafting side. And I guess in your case, although I guess it was somewhat happenstance, it maybe not so much as some of the rest of the folks who you talked to, a lot of surveyors. How'd you get into it? And, oh, well, I just kind of fell into it one day, you know, that kind of thing. But
I actually wanted to be an engineer on the railroad. That was kind of my goal. And during the mid-1980s, I'd contacted a person higher up in the railroad, and he says, well, right now, he said, this probably isn't the job to be in. We've got a couple thousand people laid off, and they'd be the first ones to come back to work. So surveying was kind of my thing I fell into. So my first 13 years, I worked for private companies in Lincoln, Nebraska. And so I did drafting and surveying, kind of 50-50, construction staking, topographic surveys, route surveys. I've done ALTA surveys, boundary surveys. But, you know, I just really enjoyed the boundary surveys the most, and because that was tying me back to my passion of history that my grandfather gave me. And so then in 1997, an opening came up at Lancaster County Engineering. Lancaster County is the county where Lincoln, Nebraska is located. So I took the position there, and I've been there for the past 17 years.
And in your situation, I know when we got a lot, obviously we have guests all over the country. And so when people talk about county surveyors, it means different things to different people. My good friend David Holland, for example, is a county surveyor for Henrico County, Virginia. But he has a different function than a county surveyor might in Colorado or Nebraska or Wyoming or somewhere, at least in some cases, because I know in some cases the county surveyor actually has some, I don't know if jurisdiction is the right word, but works with looking at survey plats. And here on the East Coast, a lot of times county surveyors do the work of the county. You know, they'll do public works projects and if there are boundaries associated with that. But in most cases, maybe I shouldn't say most, but I would probably most cases, they don't ever review other surveyors' plats. That's done by the planning department.
Right. Yep.
And so I don't know if yours falls as sort of a combination of those things or how it works in your county.
It's a really varied process in Nebraska. There's 93 counties in Nebraska, and we go from some really high populated counties of Lancaster, where Lincoln's located, and Douglas, where Omaha's located. And then we've got probably some of the poorest counties in the nation when you get out further west. And Nebraska was set up where a county surveyor for each county. Well, in some cases, that's just not feasible because there are no surveyors in that county. So then they would appoint a county surveyor from an adjacent county. So there might be one person that handles three or four different counties. And in Nebraska, the county surveyor is responsible for setting a section corner. So if there's one missing, he has jurisdiction over that. And it's worked really well where it eliminates a lot of double monuments where someone coming in and maybe doesn't have the expertise or know, you know, the different historical aspects of that county, where we've got it set up where the county surveyor is supposed to in most cases, be the one most familiar with that county. So if someone needs a section corner or quarter corner, he will call the county surveyor, and then that county surveyor will put it in. So that's kind of a system that works well here. I know other surveyors that are licensed in Nebraska from other states kind of maybe it holds them back a little bit if they come into Nebraska and they've got a job to do and they're missing some section corners and they wonder why they just can't go ahead and set that themselves, but that's our system here.
Well, at least it creates uniformity,
mm-hmm.
and that's obviously a big issue, no question about that. And so, from a funding perspective, do the funds come through just the government itself, or are there fees, or how does that work?
Well, it's really varied from county to county. Lancaster County, where I work, we've got a staff of five surveyors, and that's through taxpayer funded. and a few other counties work that way. Most of the counties, though, the county surveyor actually has a private business where he is in a dual role as he's working for himself. But when the county has work, well, then they give him a call, and then he'll bill his time to the county. In some cases, it gets to be kind of, in a way that you've really got to watch your budget, because some of the counties will budget, say, $10,000 a year for survey work. And if the particular county surveyor gets into a situation where it's going to require a lot of work, he's got to really look at what he's doing and try to look ahead. And in some counties, even though there's a state statute that says that the counties are responsible for setting back the section corners as far as the cost goes, they got to look at every situation independently. There's some really wide open areas where one rancher may own 10 sections, and so with no roads in there. So for the county to put back every section corner in that area that only affects one person, well, then they look at it a little differently.
Sure. Now, I know some cases county surveyors are elected, in other cases their employees are appointed. Mm-hmm. Is there a combination of that in Nebraska, or is everybody the same?
It's a combination. There are a lot of them that are elected, and as I mentioned earlier, some of them just, there is no county surveyor. Nobody runs for office, and so they'll call somebody from outside the area to come in and do the work. So in that case, they're appointed.
Right. And I know several guys who are in that situation you were talking about before, where the county is a client. They have other clients as well, but the county is a client for them. And then other situations where the county itself employs the surveyors, as you've been talking about. And believe it or not, we are within 45 seconds of being through our first segment.
Oh.
I told you it goes fast. But
let me just say my county is 24 miles wide by 36 miles north and south. We've got 864 sections, and I'm responsible for every corner in that area, and we are 100% monumented, but at any given time there could be corners ripped out or missing. So
yeah, that's actually pretty impressive to be 100% monumented in that size county. That's very, very interesting. Well, we're coming up on this break here, so when we get back, we'll chat just a little bit more about this, because I do have a couple of other questions,
okay.
And then I want to get into some of these projects that you've been doing that I know are going to be of great interest to our listeners today. So let's go ahead and take that break, and we'll be right back shortly.
Attention surveyors, are you aware that yellow stick you're using is saving lives all over the world? Yes, that pinfinder is clearing fields and villages of unexploded cluster bombs and other hidden explosives in over 25 countries. Johnstead, in cooperation with international mine action programs, provides free locators to where they are most urgently needed. To find out how you can help, visit the NSPS website at nsps.us.com, and thank you.
Quick Stakes is your answer to staking. Lightweight, easy to ride on, easy to use, easy to find, and won't break your back carrying them like the old-fashioned wooden stakes. Have you tried a sample? If not, get a pen and paper and write down this number, 800-438-0387, or go to quickstake.com, that's quickstake.com, and order your samples. Ask your surveying supply dealer for Quick Stakes today.
Did you miss a show that you really wanted to hear? All of our programs are available for download on americaswebradio.com and on iTunes. You can listen to your favorite programs on americaswebradio.com anytime you like.
And here's something new from Schonstedt. Did you know that Schonstedt has upped the ante on trade-ins? Now you can trade in any instrument, theirs or a competitor's, in any condition, working or not, and receive more in trade than ever before. Plus, they'll pay the freight both ways. Contact your local dealer for details or go to schonstedt.com. That's schonstedt.com.
You're listening to americaswebradio.com, the pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening.
We're back with Jerry Penry today talking about his work in Nebraska and a lot of other projects that he's been doing, kind of, I don't know, aside from, Jerry, your job or part of your job, but certainly they're interesting projects. And that before we went to break, we were talking about how the system works where you are, and I was very impressed. And I don't know whether or not that 100% monumented is a normal thing, but my sense of things in talking to people around different parts of the public land states is that's not necessarily true everywhere.
No, we've got a lot of counties that are very low, I guess, percentages as section corner goes. You know, in the central and western parts of Nebraska, the region they call the Sand Hills, there was some very, very poor surveying done, and it was fraudulent surveying done by the General Land Office. But we were fortunate to have some resurveys done in the 1910s that came back and brass capped a lot of that, but then funding ran out around 1920. But just to go back to my own county here, you know, this 100% monumentation also involves all of the section corners within the city of Lincoln, Nebraska, which is about a population of 300,000 people. And so you can imagine trying to set in all of the section corners within a major city like that. That was one of the most challenging things, where you have to go back and try to figure out how to put these back, because, you know, as many listeners know, that the cities have not been kind to section corners when it comes to paving or tearing out and replacing things. And so we stay on top of this. You know, we monitor what the city's doing for paving, what the state is doing for paving, and then, of course, our own county projects. You know, we go out and reference all the section corners ahead of time. And then as soon as the project's done, whether it be a complete reconstruction or an overlay, we go set them back. But we also developed a system where if we're monumenting a corner, we're gonna dig that up and go back as far as we can, as far as the records go, and that might go all the way back to the 1850s. And because we want one monument, and I should say one position, and if that's the original stone, from the 1850s, then our record's complete all the way back. And then we'll rebuild it to the top up with everything centered horizontally or vertically stacked on top of each other. And I've found many of the original stones from the 1850s. And it was a real eye-opener for me when I began this, because I think a lot of people kind of have the assumption that there's no way that something that old could still exist. And you know, I found hundreds of them. And it's always a thrill to have that marked section corner in my hand, knowing that someone 160 years ago had that and was chiseling the marks on there, and so I'm able to kind of jump back to his time and bring it to the future, and we document all this, and so it's a good system. That's kind of our rule.
Yeah, that's pretty exciting to be surveying on properties and finding monuments from times past. We here on the East Coast, we get to do that on some occasions, and sometimes not so much. But mm-hmm. but when you do, it's a pretty exciting day. That's for sure. Anyway, thanks for that explanation. One thing I was thinking about when you were talking about digging the corners and finding them, you talked about roadways and that kind of thing. I do hear a lot of those kind of stories about where, because of the way the roads seem to follow the section lines, or at least mm-hmm. some of the lines, whether they're section lines or I guess they are all section lines, but you see those as you fly over the country all the time, and I always mm-hmm. think about it must be hard to find those things in the middle of roads like that.
Yeah, and they're right in the middle, right in the driving, you know, right in the out in the traffic, so to speak.
Right. Yep, that's for sure. Well, I know another project that you did some work on was on the 98th Meridian, and maybe you could talk about that.
Yeah, the 98th Meridian Survey was a major triangulation network established by the U.S. Coast and Geodetic Survey, and this started in the 1890s, where they wanted to establish a triangulation network from Mexico to Canada. and then it hinged in Kansas with the transcontinental triangulation network that went east and west. And the listeners might recognize the monument called Meade's Ranch, and that was the hinge point of the north-south route with the east-west route. Well, the 98th Meridian Survey, of course, follows closely the 98th Meridian, and in Nebraska it came through from 1898 to 1901. So, you know, being that old, I started researching this, and I might add that everything that we're probably going to talk about from here on out is a hobby. I do on my spare time, so I'm not only working as a surveyor, most of my free time is out looking for stuff like this. Well, the 98th Meridian Survey, they set marble stone posts about 8 inches square for the surface monuments, and then they were double monumented, as most coast and geodetic survey triangulation stations are. But on these, they would set like a stone crock or a jug or a bowl or something like that for the lower monument. And as I started researching these, we found a lot of these marble posts still intact in some remote areas. And then they also had what was called secondary points, and these were points that just to make the triangulation network a little bit more densified. And so when these are a little harder to find because, you know, without going out there with actual excuse me, GPS, you know, you're kind of going out there blind a lot of times. So we would go out and set in the approximate area. You'd get two GPS points, send them to OPIS, get the solutions, and then we'd calculate an angle and distance to find these points. And one that sticks out in my mind was a secondary point called Carter. And Carter was a brown jug that was set. And so we found this point, and it was in a farmer's yard, you know, like a farmyard next to a steel grain bin. And he's, you know, it's always amazing because when I ask permission to do these kind of things, the landowners are always like, oh, I've never seen anything like that. You know, what are you talking about? And we stake out the position and we start digging, and all of a sudden we're picking up pieces of broken pottery. And this particular one, we recovered 70 broken pieces of this jug. I brought it home and I glued all those back together to form a jug. So I might have the listeners know I do have a website. It's called NebraskaSurveying.com, and all of the stuff that I'm kind of talking about here, I show a lot of that on my website. All the recoveries we do, I try to document those. There's over 350 links and about 2,000 photos on that website. So, NebraskaSurveying.com.
So I guess when you find things like that and the farmer's never seen any evidence, they kind of get excited about that too.
They do. There was another one in northern Nebraska. We decided, I've got a fellow surveyor that works for the Department of Roads named Gene Thompson. He's always, you know, we're always looking at where can we go, where can we find something. And we're looking for things that haven't been found in a long time. These are the ones that, you know, there's no data sheet for. There's no recent recovery. We're going to find stuff that maybe no one has found since they were set. And we knew there was a secondary point called Council Hill, and the original report didn't even say what they set there. So we set out our two points and triangulated to it with the total station, and the landowner was out there on top of this hill out in the remote pasture, and right where we had that staked out with the total station, we went out there and we eased the probe down into the ground and we hit something. So we started excavating real slowly. And you can see we found some rotted wood. I bring a metal detector with me, the coin type metal detector that'll pick up different types of metal. And we found a tack. So we set that tack aside and we keep digging slowly. And we get down about 3 or 4 feet and here's the top of this jug. It was a white jug in just pristine condition. And we excavate that. And as we're doing this, we always set out tie nails so we know, you know, that we're going to set something back exactly the way we found it. So we brought that out. And this landowner was just flabbergasted. He's like, I had no idea. And that's on the website, too. Of course, it's called Council Hill under the 98th Meridian Survey link. And you'll see pictures of that jug. And to find something like that, that nobody else would probably ever find or even know it's there, that's one of the, it's a big thrill. And we keep saying, how could we ever top this? But it seems like we keep finding new and new stuff.
Yeah, I think one of the things that, to me, is intriguing is just having the, I don't know if persistence is the right word, but to not easily give up, you know, because obviously when you're finding these things, they're not just laying on top of the ground.
Yep.
And so I've said on the show before that my primary mentor when I was learning about surveying early in my life was always talking to me about making sure my most important piece of equipment was a shovel with a really long mm-hmm. handle so I don't quit digging. But
that's
I didn't
right.
have any with a four-foot handle.
Well, you know, we've got some tile spades with about a six-foot handle on them. So, you know, I think a lot of this speaks to a surveyor. You know, we get to be not only a historian that day, but we get to be an archaeologist, and we get to be a lot of things that maybe we wanted to be, but, you know, we're a surveyor foremost. But getting to get into these other aspects, I think, is just what really appeals to a lot of people.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. I know people on the show get tired of hearing me say this, but I always use the analogy that surveyors are detectives, puzzle workers, and mind readers.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the intriguing part of the profession that keeps people doing the kind of things you're doing, and even when they're just looking for corners in general, to feel the obligation to the profession and to themselves to go through and try to find, particularly when you're looking for those historic ones.
Mm-hmm. We try to get the landowners involved as much as possible. One we did a few years ago, again out in central Nebraska. This was one of these 98th Meridian points, and the marble post had actually eroded away, and it was leaning really bad. So we tied it out, and we dug down. The landowners were watching. And that one actually had a stone bowl that was inverted with a drill hole in the bottom of the bowl.
Wow.
And that was just a beautiful bowl. I mean, I think they must have bought them brand new just for the job, because these points that we're finding, they just look really clean. And the landowners wanted that bowl. And I said, no, I don't keep anything. The only thing I take is pictures. And so they wanted that bowl, but they watched us put it back in and remonument everything, and then we put a concrete base around the top. And there was on that particular one, there was also a magnetic station that was a copper tack and a wood hub.
We're right up on our next break, so let's come back and talk about that when we come back from the break.
Okay.
Because this is another interesting story that we'll want to carry forward, so we'll be back in a couple minutes.
Schonstedt Instrument Company has been making locating easier since 1953. First, with its yellow stick, the GA52CX, the industry standard for sensitivity. Then, the GA72CD, a shorter and more rugged version offering a magnetic polarity display and a battery and sensitivity indicator. And most recently, the GA92XT, built for portability. It retracts to fit in its holster and extends for one-handed operation and fingertip control. See them all at Schonstedt.com. That's Schonstedt.com.
Don't be hoodwinked by the left, who wants you to believe the fairy tale that we can power America on butterflies, rainbows, and pixie dust. I'm Marita Noon. Get the truth about energy on my show, America's Voice for Energy, only on America's Web Radio.
With all the back and forth in today's politics, it seems as though the Constitution gets lost in the mix. If you want to brush up on your Constitution, then join Michael Conley every Wednesday from 4 to 5 p.m. for the show Our Constitution on AmericasWebRadio.com.
Quick Stakes. Does your survey supply dealer have Quick Stakes? If not, demand that they start carrying Quick Stakes. Did you know that Quick Stakes are better for your back than your local chiropractor? Lightweight and easier to use than the old heavy wooden stake. Order a sample today and prove it to yourself. Quick Stakes, your back-friendly stake.
You're listening to AmericasWebRadio.com, the pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening. You're listening to AmericasWebRadio.com, the pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening.
We're back for our third segment today with Jerry Penry, having a great conversation about the work that you do as a county surveyor is certainly interesting, and the, all of the work that you guys have done to have 100% monumented county is fantastic. Maybe more interesting is the things that we, you know, the work we were just talking about, and some of the things that you're finding. And we're at the point of the show where our sponsor, Parker Davis Quick Stakes, has a little competition every week. And I'm going to ask you a question I think I may have asked another time on the show, but we'll find out, I guess, if any of our listeners have been listening before, because if they have, then they should get this one pretty quickly. But just for the contest, now the first person who emails in to quickstakescontest@americaswebradio.com will be our winner today. So, Jerry, if you will just simply tell our audience what the initials GLO stand for.
General Land Office.
General Land Office is the answer we're looking for today. So thanks for participating in that. So we were talking about this work on the 98th Meridian, and you were talking about some of the things that, that you did. And did I understand correctly that that project that you pulled together was along that meridian all the way through the state?
Yeah, it went all the way from Mexico to Canada.
Just amazing.
Yeah.
So anyway, you were talking about a particular situation, and I had to kind of cut you off there, so
yeah.
Maybe we can pick up there and finish up with that.
Yeah, another thing that a lot of surveyors didn't realize, that there was a lot of points put out there called magnetic stations that the Coast and Geodetics set out at the turn of the century, and this one by Daly, and that was a triangulation station I was talking about. They said they set a copper tack in a wood stake about 100 feet from that triangulation station. So I got out the metal detector, and lo and behold, we found that copper tack. So,
wow.
I mean, just the things that are still out there if you take a look. Another instance on that same 98th Meridian survey, they had to have a baseline about every 100 miles. Two of those were put in Nebraska. One was in northern Nebraska by the small town of Page. And we read the latest recovery reports, and NGS, or Coast and Geodetics Survey, was out there in 1935. And they said that they did a lot of searching and prodding, and they couldn't find this one, the northern end of this baseline. And that was the last update on that recovery report. So we set out our two points, and we found both of the ends of that baseline just by total station and going out there and prodding. And I think we did that one in 2007, and this was a pretty substantial point on the end of this baseline. It was 2 foot square, and it had leading on top of it. And a couple years later, they actually tore that field up and cultivated it. But landowners saved that point, and now it's almost become a local landmark. They had to take it out of the field due to cultivation. There's still a lower point there, but this 2 foot square sandstone monument is in town now on its own pedestal, and we're working now to get a historical marker sign put next to it. So that just kind of ties in with the local community, how some of the stuff just rubs off on other people.
Oh yeah, yeah. People of all stripes get interested in history when they have something that people will explain to them. You know, they don't necessarily jump into it themselves, but they find it interesting when they do find somebody doing those kind of things. And
mm-hmm.
I know you were talking to me about another project for the Missouri River Commission, and actually in the information you sent me, you were talking about Kurt Lupke up in Montana doing some work. I actually know him.
Yep.
But anyway, maybe you could tell us about that one.
Yeah. Well, Kurt and I, we kind of found each other through this common interest in looking for all these odd points out there. The Missouri River Commission was one of the most precise surveys done in the western United States. It stretched from St. Louis all the way up to the end in Montana. and they did this survey right. It was done in the 1880s, 1890s, where they set permanent monuments for triangulation stations and their benchmarks. Triangulation stations consisted of an 18-inch square stone that was 4 inches thick. That was the lower monument. These things weighed about 120 pounds, and most of them had a drill hole in the center with a triangle and the letters U.S. on them. And then above that, they had a 4-inch steel pipe with a 5 3/4-inch cast iron cap. These cast iron caps were lettered Missouri River Commission. The triangulation stations had a triangle on them. Benchmarks had similar wording on them. And these were things that, you know, before I really got interested in this about 10 years ago, everybody kind of like, well, what are you talking about? You know, we know what Coast and Geodetic Survey is. We know what U.S. Geological Survey is. What are these marks? And so we started looking for these, and it's just been really rewarding because they were on a really precise latitude-longitude system. But, of course, it was on its own system back then that differs from today. But if you can get you can find one, get a modern position on it, and then figure the difference between the latitude and longitude of today, then you've got, then you're set. Now you can apply that to the other ones and go look for them.
So when that work was done, what was the actual purpose for the work?
They wanted to use the Missouri River as more of a route of commerce, and which was, they wanted to develop it more and more and just have it precisely mapped. They did make some very, very accurate maps. I believe there was the 1879 edition and the 1890 or 1892 edition. If you're able to view these maps, they are just the highest quality that you will ever see on a map. And the work that was done on these is just excellent. We can go back and measure to these points, and you just marvel at the work that they did back then.
And when you're talking about the people who did the work, were they somebody that the River Commission hired to do it, or were they employed by the Commission? Or?
It would be the modern equivalent of the Corps of Engineers.
Okay, all right.
Yeah, yep. So, yeah, it was the Army that did it.
I see. Well, not surprising they would be precise then, I suppose.
Yeah, and to have that kind of funding for the survey monuments that they set, and you can only imagine the guys that were set with the task of setting these monuments, because they first had to dig a square hole that would fit these 18-inch square blocks and, you know, take them down 3 or 4 feet, level them, and then build them back up with that pipe on top of them. So these, you know, you just wonder, boy, if that was your job back then, you really put in a full day's work.
Without a doubt, yeah.
And
I guess the way it was funded made it possible, because if that had been some sort of a private enterprise, it probably would have been difficult to be able to have the funding to do something like that.
And the Mississippi River Commission did a similar survey along the Mississippi River, too.
And so they did that work for their own purposes and monitoring activity along the river in terms of flood damage or those kind of things, or was that their primary purpose?
It probably just dissolved just about everything you could think of to do with the river, whether it was commerce or mapping, flood control. And later, you know, you see where some of these agencies later that came along, like Coast and Geodetic Survey, they tied into their monuments. USGS began some of their surveying off of the Missouri River Commission monument, so they trusted their work, and it's very good work.
So were they tied in any way, or would there have been any purpose to tie them in any way to the public land system?
In most cases, they're not tied to the public land system that I know of. Sometimes you'll see in the notes where they may have turned angles and distance to a section corner or something, you know, it's just a landmark. But for the most part, these are just on a latitude-longitude system.
So they weren't tied to property ownership itself. They were really tied.
Right.
It was a system all within itself for whatever their uses were along the river. Mm-hmm. Yep. Now, did the Mississippi River one cover the length of the river too, or?
I think it did. I haven't really studied that, and that's something I'd like to do someday, and maybe one of the listeners has found something like that. But they had the lower stone monuments as well as the surface pipes and caps as well. Just another big mapping project.
Right, exactly. So I would assume then if there is work to be done in terms of flood information and that type of thing, these monuments by the commission with all their ties to river elevations themselves would be very useful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And they've kind of, for the most part, a lot of these Missouri River Commission and probably the Mississippi River Commission monuments have taken a back seat to the Coast and Geodetic and the U.S. Geological Survey marks. And you won't find very, very many of them on data sheets unless they were tied in by one of the other agencies. So they're kind of sitting out there by themselves. And the great thing about the Internet now is through Google Books or whatever, you can find the Corps of Engineers annual reports and stuff that list the descriptions of these monuments, where they're at, and they also have the latitude, longitude of these points. And it's just been a really fun project to go out and play detective on these things.
Yeah, I can imagine that it would. And we've got a minute and a half or so before our break. And I know we want to get into our next section, our last segment, actually talking about some recoveries you've done in the Black Hills in South Dakota. And it just seems as though you have this, as you said in one of your pieces to me, this treasure trove of things that you've been able to get involved in. Yeah. And with the enormity, it seems, of all the things that you're doing, you must be doing this every weekend.
Yeah, it's pretty much my free time, we took a few years ago. We went to Hawaii, and I found about six or eight monuments in Hawaii.
I wrote a thing a few years ago, sort of like Jeff Foxworthy. You might be a redneck if it's you might be married to a surveyor if.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
One of them was if everywhere you go, your husband is looking for survey markers.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's just the way we are. You know, we walk down the street, we'll see something and stop to see if it means anything.
Right.
But you've certainly taken that to a whole new level in terms of all your all the work you've done. And actually, you've done some writing on this. Maybe we can talk about that when you come back, too.
Okay.
And give people,
sure.
I know we talked about the website before, but if there's other ways for people to find out what you're doing, or maybe even, I don't know if you do this as a participatory kind of activity or not, maybe other people would be interested in joining up and or even identify other projects that you might be interested in. So hopefully the radio show will open up some of those opportunities. So.
Sure.
Well, let's go to that last break, and we'll be back shortly.
Getting into underground utility location? If so, you'll want to know about the Schonstadt Instrument Company's MPC kit, a multi-purpose combo for locating both ferrous objects and underground pipes and cables. And because it consists of two instruments in one package, it qualifies for trade-in allowances on two locators. Any kind, any make, any condition. Contact your dealer for details. Or visit www.schonstadt.com. That's schonstedt.com.
Hello, I'm Dr. Mike Karuchak. Have you ever wondered what doctors talk about amongst themselves? If you do, join us on the Doctor's Lounge and hear the doctors' conversations amongst themselves. Join me and my co-host, Dr. Hal Schertz, every Thursday morning, 8 to 9 a.m.
With all the back and forth in today's politics, it seems as though the Constitution gets lost in the mix. If you want to brush up on your Constitution, then join Michael Conley every Wednesday from 4 to 5 p.m. for the show Our Constitution on AmericasWebRadio.com.
QuickStakes. Does your survey supply dealer have QuickStakes? If not, demand that they start carrying QuickStakes. Did you know that QuickStakes are better for your back than your local chiropractor? Lightweight and easier to use than the old heavy wooden stake. Order a sample today and prove it to yourself. Quick Stakes, your back-friendly steak.
You're listening to AmericasWebRadio.com, the pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening.
Welcome back, everyone. We're talking with Jerry Penry today, and we've been talking about a lot of the things that he's been doing, and we're going to talk more about that. But before we went to break, and earlier you had mentioned the website, but before we went to break, I was talking about some writings that you had done related to your work. Maybe we'll talk about that some.
One of the first books I put together was called Nebraska's Early Geodetic Surveys. And this is kind of a compilation of research that I had, and I thought, well, you know, what good does it do for me to just have this and not be able to share it? So I put it into a book, and it really explains how Nebraska was mapped, you know, horizontally and vertically, aside from the public land survey systems. So that's been a really good book and an eye-opener for a lot of people. I also, last year, had the Instructions to County Surveyors of Nebraska. That was a book that our first state surveyor put together in 1914, and I had it republished for the 100th anniversary. That's been a very good topic. I've done seminars on that. Robert Harvey was just an outstanding surveyor, and he uncovered a lot of the fraudulent work that was done in the GLO surveys, and this particular book avoids all of the stuff that's in the normal surveying textbooks, and he talks about how to find the old pits and mounds and how the shortcut system to subdivide a township was done, and so that's been very rewarding to get that in the hands of a lot of people. And my latest project, it should be out in about a month, is called American Survey Monument Patents. And this book goes all the way back to the 1860s and shows the various patents that people have developed on survey monuments. And it tells the story of an early struggle for surveyors wanting to have a permanent monument, such as iron or something, in the ground for a section corner instead of the usual earthen pits and mounds or stake or stone. And it brings it all the way up to the most recent 2014 monument. So look for that. It should be out in about a month, American Survey Monument Patents.
And I assume people can find out about all of these on your website.
Yeah, yep, they're listed on the website.
What was that website again? Make sure everybody...
NebraskaSurveying.com.
Okay.
Just spell the word NebraskaSurveying.com.
No space, just Nebraska Surveying.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay. Well, I know one of the other topics you talked to me about was some work up in the Black Hills of South Dakota, which was kind of intriguing to me as well. So maybe you could talk about that.
Well, I've made many trips up to the Black Hills of South Dakota, and my wife's from that area. And I also have met Kurt Lupke from Montana up there about four times. We go up there and we look for the old stuff that nobody's found in a long time. And people may not realize that USGS was in there as early as 1890 doing triangulation networks. And they had a network in 1890 where they set an astronomical station, a baseline in 91, and then they had networks in 1893 and 1897. So we go up and look for these points and some very remote areas. We're using descriptions from 115 years old. And one of the other things that are up there is many of the USGS benchmarks from around 1898 on the Deadwood Datum. Now, I've written a story on this, I believe it was last year, for American Surveyor magazine, on the various early USGS datums. And USGS had to get started on a lot of their mapping areas where they just didn't have true sea level elevations. So they had to pick an elevation from somewhere and go with it. And in the Black Hills, they chose what they had called the Deadwood Datum. They had about 350 benchmarks set up there. So we've got the old notes, and we're getting into some really remote areas, and we've recovered at least 50 of these old monuments.
Yeah, you mentioned Deadwood. I guess that's in some way connected to the town?
Yep. The Deadwood Datum began in the town of Deadwood from an elevation supplied by the railroad, and USGS says, okay, if this is good for you, we'll go with this with this elevation, and all of the deadwood datums were based upon that one elevation supplied by the railroad. And that's the way USGS did it on many areas across the country.
That's interesting. The reason I was familiar with the town is I went to school in Blacksburg, Virginia, where Virginia Tech is, and then worked there for 15 years after school. And for some reason, the town of Blacksburg, Virginia, and Deadwood, South Dakota, became like sister cities.
Hmm.
So every summer, fall, there would be a big festival in downtown Blacksburg called Deadwood Days. Which was kind of interesting. I'd never been to Deadwood that I know of, but that's the connection that I made when you were talking about Deadwood, and I figured it had to be something to do with around the town.
Well, the Black Hills is really, you know, to use the word gold here, it's a gold mine for surveyor monuments. You know, you've got early USGS and Coast and Geodetic Survey. You've got the Forest Reserve boundary monuments around the Black Hills National Forest. There's location monuments. There's the old GLO monuments. There's mining claims. There is just thousands of monuments up there for the surveyor to go up there and find.
So I assume you plan your trips up there when they're not doing the big motorcycle thing at Sturgis.
Well, yes, but I actually, I'm a motorcyclist, so I do go up to Sturgis as well, but that's not the time to be up there looking around for survey monuments, so that's a separate trip.
Yeah, that's probably true. Oh. Probably true. Well, I know you've got some other things coming up. You were talking about a seminar series you were looking at in a couple of years, or actually next year, I guess, now that we're into 2015.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're going to, this fall, we just had our winter seminar in Nebraska this past weekend. This summer, we're going to have the summer seminar on, it's going to be July 17th at a place in northwestern region of Nebraska, Fort Robinson. Fort Robinson was an old military reservation established in 1874. Around the boundary of this military reservation, they put in these large cast iron monuments to mark the boundary. Well, through the years, people have pilfered these monuments and disappeared and whatsoever. And so we're going to have our summer seminar up there. It's going to be a working seminar, but we're going to go up and try to find what's left up there. And some of them are leaning over. We're going to true them up and maybe put a base around them and just get a good documentation of try to preserve and protect what's left up there. And then next summer, be the summer of 2016, I'm going to host the summer seminar in central Nebraska at Halsey National Forest. And listeners might be scratching their head about National Forest in Nebraska. That's interesting. Well, Nebraska does have a few national forests, and two of them are man-made. The Sandhills region of Nebraska is basically just rolling prairie with sand. And in the early part of the 1900s, they figured that they could go out there and just start planting different species of pine trees, and they developed these national forests. And a lot of the national forest area is still just native grasslands. But in 1915, there was a complete resurvey done of the interior townships. And in this national forest, we're going to have another working seminar where we're going to divide into teams and go look for these GLO brass caps within one township and see how many of these we can recover.
So are those open to anybody who wants to attend them, or are they set up
Okay. Yep, they're open to anybody that wants to attend. Just you can contact me or just kind of watch for the Nebraska seminars coming up. And be a great opportunity to get out and mingle with surveyors with like minds. And it's not going to be as easy as people think. Sometimes you think of Nebraska as being everything's got either fences or roads, but there's some areas out there where you're going to have to do some calculating and some thought process to find these.
Yeah. Now, does the society in Nebraska use these kind of things as that people can do as part of their continuing education issues? Or
yeah, mm-hmm. 5th, we will have continuing education hours, so we'll have your professional development hours, and so yeah, you can sign up, and it'll count just like a regular class.
Except it'll be more interesting, probably, than many of the ones that we do otherwise.
Yeah, you know, we kind of, sometimes we need a break, I think, from the office just to get out. And
oh, yeah.
You can only go to so many seminars where you're the listener, and I think everybody wants to participate, and this is going to be a chance where you can participate. This summer, the one I mentioned at Fort Robinson, we're also going to have a chaining contest, and we're going to find some really rugged areas out there. And get a measurement on that on a line, and then have people chain and see just how difficult it was for these early surveyors to chain across this.
Oh yeah, that'll be a fun thing to do.
Yeah.
And we just did. I was at our Virginia conference a couple of weeks ago, and we had a mock trial that went really well. We had a real judge and two real attorneys as part of it, and then some of us participated as either clients or surveyors or whatever, but it's fun to do those kind of things, and you get, not that you don't learn from the other ones when you're basically being lectured to, but if you have participatory things, I think it's helpful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think when you get to participate in something, it's, you know, you're actively involved, and it probably means a little bit more to you that you're able to, you know, share your, not only your own knowledge, but be out there with like-minded surveyors, and it's just going to be a great time.
Yeah, and particularly the kind of thing you're doing, you actually, people get an opportunity to talk about different perspectives on how things get done, you know, that type of thing. So you're always sharing ideas back and forth, whereas in classroom settings, most of the time you don't get to do that, you know. So
mm-hmm.
Certainly true. Well, we're about a minute away from the end of the show, so I don't want to fail to thank you for being with me and sharing all this information with the audience today, because I know everybody's found this to be of interest, and hopefully you'll get some hits on the website or people contacting you to learn more about what you've been doing, and maybe it'll inspire people to do something similar. You know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's always I find what I do in my personal time just only enhances, you know, what I do in my actual work time, so just work hand in hand.
Well, it's certainly a lot of great experience and a lot of interesting things you've been doing, so hopefully, again, people will go to that NebraskaSurveyor.com, is that right?
Yeah, surveying, NebraskaSurveying.
Surveying.com, and
yep.
And take a look at the things you've been in. And thanks so much again, Jerry. It's been great having you on the show today.
Yeah, thank you, Kurt. Thank you, listeners.
This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.